I am overjoyed here. I could barely sit. I was overjoyed that you read that poem so many times because I couldn't find a story that was going to connect with what I wanted to talk about. And that poem is the best poem, the best articulation of what I want to talk about. And so I was going to read the poem because I couldn't think of anything else to do. And then you read it so many times. It was so beautiful. Because this is a lot of what I want to talk about. I know last week Susan talked about just emotions in general, just to have a sense of emotions. And we all have our opinions about emotions and what they are and ones we like and ones we don't like and all of that. But several years ago, I started practicing with emotions. So you may not know this, but I do a lot of non-residentials weekends all over the country. And I've been doing it for a while now. So I go to Houston and, St. Louis and different places and give these non-residentials over the weekend. And at first, I used to make up something every single time I went somewhere, and then I figured out that that was mind-boggling. So I decided to create a non-residential, and then that's what I taught everywhere I went for the whole year. And one year, I did it on cultivating awakening emotions. I was amazed that there's a whole emotional piece in Dhamma that we skip over and we don't really talk about. But that emotional piece is very necessary for our awakening. This poem points to that. So that's what I want to talk about. I figured since we're talking about emotions, this is the perfect time to talk about these awakening emotions. I call them awakening emotions because to me, they lead to awakening. And we don't just spin around in them. So I thought I would start by telling you the difference between the two so you understand that, and then talk about I found three sets of them. And so then talk about the three sets that I have. So first of all, emotions in general in our lives. I'm not going to talk so much about the what they are, but there's some things we can begin to notice about emotions in general. One is that a lot of our general regular emotions are conditioned on something that's going around in our outer world. So if I get some bad news, I'm gonna feel emotionally connected. But these awakening emotions have nothing to do with outer conditions. They can show up and support us in ways that even seem like they go against whatever the outer conditions are. So even as practitioners, we know we have felt emotionally connected to a situation, even though the situation itself might be something that's troubling. So they're not connected. They don't just show up and connect, and they're not conditioned on whatever's happening in our outer world. When we're in our regular emotions, the emotional energy of just being human, we can get trapped in that energy and actually begin to be dependent on things happening a certain way in order for us to free ourselves from the emotion or stay in the emotion. So if we're feeling emotionally the positive emotions, then we get trapped in trying to create an environment that will keep us in that emotion. And likewise, when we get in a unpleasant or what we would consider negative emotions, we look to our environment to try to create a world where we can get out of those emotions. But with these awakening emotions, when they are present, we have the greatest opportunity for insight. It's in that emotion when they show up that we're not entrapped or ensnared in them. They actually provide like a window of seeing that we don't normally see. And so they're more, instead of encasing us, entangling us, they are more freeing and allow us to relate and see and experience a situation completely different than we normally would. So the third thing is that our regular emotions, regular general human emotions, they arise out of our perception. Whatever we think is going on, they arise out of our beliefs and they arise out of our habits. So if we have the habit to get irritable, then we're going to be irritable every day. At some point, we're going to have some level of irritability. Not because the situation or life is irritable, but because we have the habit of being irritable. And so irritability becomes part of our everyday existence and helps us know we are who we are. And a lot of our emotions are like that. They're based in perception and they're based in our beliefs about what we're experiencing and what's right and what's wrong, and they're based in habit. But these awakening emotions do not come from perception, belief, or habit. They are connected to what I consider like an inner core, a value system that has very little to do with our expectations in the world. It has more to do with connected to something that's, I think, in Dhamma, we open up this access to our inner core, and these awakening emotions connect to that. They connect our inner core to some moment in time. And I think it's why they support us in awakening. So our regular emotions are connected to perception, belief, and habits, these awakening emotions are connected to values, our sila, our dhamma, the precepts, and wisdom. So we learn things in dhamma. We don't even know we've learned it. But at some point in time, that wisdom shows up in our lives and we get connected to the wisdom more than we are connected to whatever's happening. The fourth thing is that the regular emotions are connected to what I consider to weakness, meaning that when we get caught in emotions and entrapped in these regular emotions, in a way they bring about a sense of weakness, like somehow we're not strong enough, we're not capable, especially the negative ones. We even get afraid, though, of the positive ones, like, I don't want to get too happy because something bad's going to come right around the corner. So we kind of like, it's a weakness to just pull on into emotions in life. And so if they're the unpleasant ones or the negative ones, then it's like somehow I failed and that's why I feel bad. I did something wrong. So they're connected to some kind of weakness, some kind of vulnerability or some fear that, the future is not going to be quite right. But these awakening emotions are not connected to weakness. They're connected to strength. So even if we're in a low part of the trough, there's a level of strength in these emotions that carry us up like in the water. It's like the water carries us up and these awakening emotions carry us up. And then there's one more thing that I noticed about the difference between the two. our regular emotions are, I would call worldly. So they're connected to the eight worldly winds, and they flow like that. They move us about like the worldly winds. The eight worldly winds are also called the eight concerns. They're the four pairs: pleasure, pain, gain, loss, praise, blame, and fame and ill repute. So we're always caught within one of those four, being tossed about in the world. And our emotional relationship with life is also tossed about within those winds. But these awakening emotions I'm going to talk about here in just a second, they are unworldly. They come, they provide meaning in the moment, but they are not the moment. They're not part of the winds. I would say it feels more like divine or grace. They feel like we've somehow stumbled into or connected to something larger than ourselves, and that we're being carried about by this divinity or this grace or this universal knowing that we're being carried with, and we're not being tossed about by worldly conditions. It's what I think this poem is pointing to. When we're in the trough, we can't see what's going on, and we can get disoriented and start trying to fight our way through it. And in that fighting, we get more disoriented, and we can drown. More flailed and tossed about. But if we're still, and stillness in these awakening emotions actually is possible, when we're still in these emotions, the emotions themselves rise up and bring us to a completely different understanding. So the reason why I think these emotions are tied to that poem is because most every time I felt any of these emotions, I did not feel them in a what I would consider a positive situation. I felt them in a low part. But because I was able to be steady with it, and I could begin to see the difference between regular emotions and these awakening emotions, then the emotions themselves brought me up out of all kinds of situations. That's why I thought the trough is the best poem to read. We think oftentimes when we're in some low part that something's amiss, something's wrong, and we can get trapped. We can get trapped in it. But actually, I begin to see that some of these low parts are actually a gift that is designed to strengthen our faith in practice and move us further along, onward leading. So let me talk a little bit about the three pairs the three sets that I found. The first set is the one that we usually are connected to, is metta. But not metta as in saying metta. That's not what makes this an emotional awakening emotion. It's the cultivation of the quality of metta, the cultivation of the quality of kindness as a capacity itself, is what gives us the ability to be with all kinds of situations. I mean, there's all kinds of difficulties we face as practitioners. We're coming up against a lot of life itself, and oftentimes our practice comes in direct conflict with the life that we're actually around. And metta as a capacity is this capacity to settle, to be kind, to be gentle, to be soft with life itself, to compassion is not something that, it's not a salve that I like, oh, poor you. Compassion is more like a being soft or kind in the midst of difficulty. And that, in our normal way of thinking, is the opposite. When they're suffering, we need to fight. We need to get in there and do something, or we got to get up out of here. One of these things. But with metta, the very nature of difficulty is brings in with it a softening quality. So I found when I started practicing that if somehow practice, and I cultivate metta just as a thing, because I can't make metta show up when I need it. That's the thing about these awakening emotions. You got to rest in the trough itself and let the trough carry you up, not you. So I had to cultivate metta as a thing, but then I noticed when I would have like tension with my family or some difficulty was showing up, that metta would show up to help me get through without losing myself. So this capacity for metta is not something we cultivate at the time we're stressed out about something. Metta is what we cultivate, and metta shows up when we're at the low part of a situation and carries us up. Joy. I have found joy in some of the most difficult moments in my life. This was right after, I did this right after the teacher training started, and there was a lot of difficulty going on about that teacher training starting, and yet I would have all this joy. I did not get sucked into a lot of the negativity that was going on, because at the time, Spirit Rock and IMS were splitting. So they were having two separate teacher trainings, and who was going to go to one? And there was all this anger about who you choose and why were you not going there and you should go here. And it was all that energy. And I just kind of parted the sea with all this joy and kindness. And I was just so floating on the whole thing. And I think it's because of cultivating metta as a quality, as an emotional capacity that I will need in my lifetime. The second is a pair. And maybe I'll have to give an evening talk or something on these, because I don't really have time to talk about it completely right now. But the second pair is a pairing that we don't always talk about. It's Samvega and Pasada. I don't even know if you've heard the word Samvega Pasada. I have never even heard of it, but Samvega is this emotional state of futility. There is no point of going any further. Now, that can seem, when you first hear it, like that's a good thing, but it actually is. When we surrender to the moment and we let go of trying to force our way to make something the way we want it, we get out of the tussle of trying to make something a certain way, and we rest actually in the trough, that acceptance of the futility of it is what carries us into Pasada. And Pasada is a clear pathway out. So this poem is basically saying you are down in the trough, which is this Samvega. Can't see nothing. I don't know. I'm through trying. I'm not doing it anymore. I can't. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to fix this. I don't have any other choice than to trust. And in that moment, that Samvega, that surrender into the futility of it all, is what helps bring us to the shore, to the top, the crest again. And we can see a path and say, oh, this is what I'm going to go. This is what happened with the Buddha. It's how he left when there was so much futility in his life, and he left and he could not do his life the way he did. He didn't know where he was going or how he was going to do it. But I can't do this. It's what happens with people who are finally ready to let go of drugs or alcohol. They reach this point of, I just cannot go any further with this. I don't know where I'm going, but I'm not going here. That I know. And that sense of surrender, rather than collapsing and fighting, is what Samvega is. It is in this futility that we finally still ourselves, relax, and let the waves itself bring us back up to the top. And then we find a path, which is what Pasada is, the clear following of a path. But we can trust that path because the path comes on the heels of our surrender. It's not something we made happen. It's something that shows up almost like divinity, like grace when we have surrendered. Learning to be with that sense of surrender is not a weakness. The weakness is I can't be down here. I got to make my way. What that surrender is it's a sense of strength. Like I don't know how to describe it, but when you feel it, you know it. You know that you have let go of needing to fix it yourself. And that letting go actually creates a sense of strength in us that we have the capacity to deal with. The last two are another pair that we don't often talk about, but it's Hiri and Otapa. Hiri, H-I-R-I, and Otapa, O-T-T-A-P-A. Otapa, Hiri is the moral shame. It's another one of these like moral shame. Oh my God, that's got to be terrible. But it's not that. What it is it's when we finally come to an internal place that says, I do not want to harm anybody else. I don't want to harm me anymore, and I don't want to harm anyone else. And you get to that place in Dhamma. When Dhamma begins to seep into us, we begin to see that what's more important than anything else is this idea of harming. And I want to know when I'm harming, and I want to be done with the harming. You're not going to be, you don't have to be afraid of me. That's that kind of energy. But to get there, we got to see a lot of harm. We see harm everywhere. It's all over the place. We see how much we're harming all the time. There's just harm, 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 harm. And it feels like it's overwhelming how much harm is going on. But when we begin to see that harm as a natural part of life, that harm just happens, then our sort of, I don't know what it is. It's the, I guess, a back straight kind of vow that I will not harm begins to show up. When we don't see harm, when we kind of like live in a world that says, I'm not a harming person. I'm not going to harm anyone. No, I'm not going to do any harm. No harm around my life. Then we kind of live in this denial kind of world and we cause harm all over the place. When we begin to see it, as painful as it is, we begin to understand it. We begin to understand where it comes from, and that understanding in this low spot brings us up. Otapa is on the heels of this, which is for the outward condition, I don't want to do anything wrong. So there's a kind of a way in which our own behaviors, there's a safety, I guess, in how we begin to be. We're less caught in trying to make the world non-harm and more aware of our own blame, our own conduct. And so we just connect to that, our own conduct. So these three pairs, the metta and the four connecting pieces of metta, the Brahmaviharas itself, like metta, compassion, joy, and equanimity, that capacity, the capacity for Samvega to surrender and to allow the path to bring itself to us, and this capacity to begin to tackle this issue of harm and how harm affects each of us and how we are with harm, both our intended harm and our unintended harm. We begin to see all of that. And this actually is a game changer on how we are in awakening. Because we're less and less and less trying to make practice some kind of self-help tool that makes me look a certain way. And we let go of all of that, trying to put our practice in front of us the way we want to look. And we actually surrender to the practice. And the practice carries us to a completely different way of being. And it's from that trough that we become, I don't know how to describe it. You already have seen this in your life. So I'm not telling you something. I'm giving you words about it. But you've already seen yourself act in a way that you never saw yourself act. Like, who did that? Who was that? That could have been me. That's not me. I don't know what happened. Where did all that kindness come from? Or just that ability to give up in the middle of some struggle and say, yeah, I'm not going to try to fix this. I'm just going to wait and see what happens. Trust in it, whatever. And all of this, or even our sense of, we really do think about harm in a way that we've never thought about it before we came into the Dhamma. And now, you know, just the idea of harming someone can be a big deal inside our souls. Like, what do I do? How do I fix that? I never really cared about other people before Dhamma. It's not like I wanted to go around and be mean. But, you know, if you got harmed by something I did, I'm like, you must have did something to make that happen. It's not me. I'm just responding to you. I mean, it's that kind of energy. That's the way we are in the world. And yet, when you come into Dhamma and you begin to awaken, then now you want to actually move in a way that's more in alignment with the Dhamma, which is what I think the practice is. So that's what I wanted to talk about. Like, we're going to talk about emotions a little bit more, but sometimes when you're in a really low spot, you may not be in a low spot, just some regular emotion. You may be in the midst of an awakening moment where insight's possible if you're willing to stop flailing about trying to get out of the low spot and let this low spot teach you what it is that we need to know about awakening. So, yeah, that's where I think I want to leave it. Thank you so much. It seems a lot to kind of cram in here, but I just wanted to make sure that we begin to understand that not all low emotions, or what we consider bad emotions or low times in our lives, not always is it negative. Sometimes it is the gift we need to really make a change. So I thought we would talk a little bit about this. And I'll divide us up into breakout rooms, but I want to give people an opportunity to say goodbye if they want to, while I put us in some breakout rooms. And then we can kind of share with each other. All right, so I'll give you 15 minutes. Kind of that's good enough time. That's a fair amount of time to kind of talk about, you know, this is a difficult thing because some of what I'm talking about are difficult moments. So don't feel compelled to talk about really, really difficult moments. You can keep it in your head if you want and just talk about what you think about all of this and let it rest down in the heart when you're by yourself or a little further along. All right, I think we're back here. We'll see if anybody has any comments that they want to share about their, maybe what you, it's, what, you know, just about the cock itself and about this idea that some of these low periods in our lives can be the most awakening in our lives.
Tawari, is it okay if I say something?
Sure.
Yeah. So, not responding exactly to that prompt, as much as to say that, I was in a room with, two people who are newer to the practice and who are young and who are getting it, in terms of, you know, opening your heart and metta. And, you know, I just am always so deeply grateful when I see people entering this path who are in the sort of prime of their work lives and their influence in so many aspects of the world, and bringing an open heart to their work and a lens that's very different from the lens that I started out with in my younger life.
Yeah, that's right. That's what happens to us. That's exactly what I'm pointing to. It's the practice that's doing that. It's not us. We're not like fixing ourselves and finally I figured it all out. It's the practice, as Philip would say, that is doing us rather than we're doing the practice. And somehow it begins to do us in a way that changes things. It's actually carrying us to the crest of the water and we can see a way forward. Great. Yeah, go ahead, Kelby.
Iris, I just wanted to say it's funny that you mentioned that because I was in a different group, but two of us in there were also like newer on the path and like felt like completely different people. So
yeah,
it's really cool.
You can see that, right? This is what's happening. And it's actually, you know, the Buddha pointed to suffering as the first ennobling truth. So suffering is the doorway in. But yet we really hate suffering in the thinking mind, right? The egoic side of our mind thinks that suffering means something's wrong, something's bad. But in the real sense, when you get deeper and deeper into practice, you begin to realize that all that suffering is actually what is keeping you solidly on the path and keeping a level of wisdom around you. So the suffering becomes more of the gift, that which is grace, rather than that which is problems. But it takes something to change that paradigm, understanding that suffering is not the problem. Suffering is actually the doorway in. It's a paradigm shift that nobody can make happen. It just sort of gradually, over time, begins to happen. That's good.
Hey, Tawari.
Yeah, I guess.
I really appreciated it being explained in this. I've never heard these things phrased in this way, and it really put things in perspective of a few different events that have happened for me, and I really appreciate that talk. It was really, really helpful.
Yeah, I've never heard it talked like this either. I was back during Cascadia, Inside Dialogue. We do these retreats and, we do them up north in the Samish Island. And one year, several years ago, the Dhamma that we were going to use for that retreat was Samvega Pasada. And I've never heard of Samvega Pasada before in my life. And I'm sitting in a room with all these, inside people, teachers talking about some Vega Pasada, oh, this is what we should use and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, I hate to say it, you guys, but I have no idea what you're talking about. And then I read this article and thought to myself, oh my God, that's what happened to me. That's what happened when I stepped on the path. I had a moment of some Vega when the futility of the way I was doing life just was so clear. It just did not seem like it was going to work. And why we don't talk about that, I don't know. I guess because, you know, what I'm really talking about is the futility of life, the harming other people, moral shame, and just this sense of, you know, not wanting to do anything wrong. It's like those kinds of Dhamma talks, they don't come across very nice. They don't come across like, oh, yes, joy and happiness. And so we don't really talk about it, but all of us have experienced that sense of the lowness of it actually making our lives better. And so I think that's probably why we don't really talk about it so much. But once I read that article, I was destined to practice with it. That was it. I was just like, oh my God, I got to investigate this and see what it is that it's saying. It was really some vega pasada when I read this article from the Buddha's life and how much he was feeling some vega and pasada. And I realized that it is an emotional part of life that's very, very necessary. And that's when I begin to see that there was two types of emotions, the emotional energy that leads us into wisdom and insight, and the emotional energy that just kind of spins us around and gets us all entrapped and we're trying to figure out how to make myself happy again. That's good. Well, look.
Do we have time for one more?
Yeah.
I'm speaking to Hiri and Otapa, and I'm just looking at this one little example and seeing how it might be a reflection in my life in terms of compassion and not wanting the suffering around me. And so here's the example. I have a spider that lives behind a mirror, and it is not going to survive, right, behind a mirror. And so I caught a fly, and I just happened to toss it in the direction of, I guess, was like dust in a net, and the spider came out and ate it or took it. So part of me is like, oh, wow, you know, that happened. It did eat it. And then part of me is like, well, I'm intervening. My ego feels a little jazzed about, you know, having fed this creature, and I took something else's life. And then I'm seeing it as kind of a metaphor about how I perhaps am not willing to just let nature take its course, in especially around family situations that I'm feeling I have compassion, yet I'm not really willing to see the suffering. So that I'm wondering if that's kind of a metaphor for what I'm looking at in my life, and why did I choose to do that?
It could very well be that. What I would also have you consider is how much energy and time you have given to a spider, that we don't normally give that kind of effort and care to beings that are so tiny, insignificant in our lives, but that the idea that you could be that connected to the spider and the spider's well-being, and begin to understand that spider's well-being in relation to your own well-being, is what Dhamma is. Just like me, just like me, just like me. And it's not just like me in terms of people, but just like me in terms of little tiny ants, little tiny beings, trees, all kinds of existence that we pre-Dhamma would just not even pay attention to. Unless that just happens to be your forte and you happen to be into bugs. But if you're not into bugs, you know, it's like, whatever. You're in my house. Let's move out. Let's find you somewhere else to go. But just the care is, and being able to see a relationship between the spider's life and your life is something that Dhamma does. Brings it all in perspective. That's good. I probably should stop so that Chris can do some metta. But just think on this. You can look at insight, access to insight, and type in the words Samvega, S-A-M-V-E-G-A, just like it sounds, and Pasada, just like it sounds, P-A-S-A-D-A, or Hiri and Otapa, and just have at it. Start reading up on it. Access to insights, the greatest place in the world. If I hear a Dhamma word I don't know, I'm typing it in there, and I'm going to do some reading. And they have many people have talked about it, and you can begin to see how it shows up in your life, not just from this one talk. All right?